Hi again, Dreamers. I wanted to take a few minutes today to go over some things I wasn't able to get to at the end of last weekend's episode 52. We've had a very lengthy discussion on Facebook about Elliot Rodger. And can we take a moment to acknowledge the fact that we all agree, for once, that he pretty much set the douchebaggery level way high with his ridiculous manifesto and accompanying videos. And I've said, admittedly, that I've had fleeting moments of empathy for the struggles with the bullying. But when looking at the overall big picture he painted of his life for us, those moments were actually pretty few and far between. And his parents saved him every time he went crying to them. I want to go over the comment thread that we had about this story. And I want to talk about this incel movement on the internet. I'm also going to talk to you about an article that was shared with us on the Facebook page as well. And at the end, we will take a look at the victims of the Isla Vista massacre. So first, on Facebook, I asked you guys what you made of Elliot Rodger. Does the fact that he was bullied play into this? And what about his parents? Are they in any part to blame? Darren J said that he did not believe the bullying played a direct problem, that it was a sense of entitlement and not getting his own way. Elizabeth C. and Tracy D. agreed with Darren that we, looking at his manifesto, are only privy to his perceptions of bullying. This was about entitlement and not having his way. Darren also added that Roger's attitude in general was likely to have played a factor in him being singled out by bullies. While that may very well be true, I still have to point out that it's not a real good excuse. I get it, but still, bullying just can't be justified. Jeanette S. said that she feels sorry for the child that he was before he manifested his pain into violence. She wondered if, as a child, he was overlooked and given material possessions in place of real love. She equated this to the spoiled brat syndrome gone way wrong. She went on to say that it's possible that he felt abandoned, that his feelings of entitlement were created to fill a void. It's different for everyone, and so many of us walk through life with different levels of issues from our childhood. But it's that one in many who burns it all the way down rather than becoming the light to rise above the pain. Very well said, Jeanette. Very well said. Emily H. also agreed that Roger didn't get enough attention from his parents, so they bought him things. He spent his life craving love and acceptance from others due to what was lacking at home, perhaps. She suggested that he may have benefited from counseling, but we'll never really know. Well, Roger did sporadically seek professional help at the behest of his parents, but he seemed resistant, and he refused to take the medications that he would be prescribed. Christy, who has quite an interesting spelling of her first name, and said it would be okay with her if I just called her Christy, as the guys over at the Brohio podcast and the Mysterious Circumstances podcast have resoundingly butchered her name enough. And she is the one who posted the article in the comment thread entitled, "Your Princess is in Another Castle, Misogyny, Entitlement, and Nerds." And I will talk about this article after I get through the comments. Thanks, Christy, for sharing the article. Zach V., at the time he commented, had only gotten through half of part one when he said Roger was pretty spoiled, rich even. He also seems to not have a very good understanding of the world in general. And as for calling his dad father, that stood out to him as well. I didn't like that either. It sounded kind of stuck up, but maybe I'm being judgy. Who calls their dad father? Anyone? Maybe his dad made him refer to him in that way? Maybe it's a British aristocracy kind of a thing. I have no idea. Jennifer S. said that Roger didn't have the tools needed to fit into society, especially with teens, but clearly with the stepmother too. He's painfully pretentious and narcissistic. He expects everyone to approach him and is pissed off when they don't. She agreed that there were early warning signs his parents should have taken seriously, and she's never really seen anyone who could have benefited more from some intensive therapy. She said it's heartbreaking on many levels and pointed out that he had a life coach, but nobody saw that he needed much more than that. Darren J. chimed in again and said that this was definitely a hard lesson, and I very much agree. Roger was very self-centered with no real grasp on reality. He does think his parents needed to take a lot of responsibility for Roger's behavior, as Darren would never let his son spend all his time on his game console and deprive himself of social interaction. I agree wholeheartedly with that for certain. Didn't it seem like they did things to get away from him rather than to do things with him? They never signed him up for an organized sports, and they never went to any of his games. And many of us did that for years as parents. I can't tell you how many summers I spent sitting on a soccer field or on softball bleachers. And in the fall it was basketball, and in the spring it was volleyball. And I went to every single one of them because I really enjoyed seeing my kid play and being part of a team. Anyway, Darren also pointed out that Roger constantly talked about not having sex, but makes no attempts to meet any girls at all. And Jennifer S. again agreed, saying that he just sat there, probably looking very unapproachable, waiting for the world to come to him, and that nobody ever took the time to tell him that the world doesn't work like that. I told Jennifer I could not stop reading this guy's manifesto, and she totally gets me. She agrees, it's like watching a train wreck in slow motion. Alfonso J. had something to say in defense of Roger's parents. That Roger didn't confide in them about his jealousy of others and inadequacies. He thinks that maybe that they tried, but Roger was the one who built a wall to keep them out. I can kind of see that. They could only know what he was willing to show them. But I don't think that they could have possibly known his jealousy was festering into homicidal and suicidal rage. But I will say this. I do think that they helped build that wall between themselves and their son. His dad allowed his wife to drive that wedge between them, when clearly the stepmom was the one who saw that Roger needed some serious boundaries and life lessons. I feel like Dad needed to do more to bridge the gap between his wife and his son rather than recoiling from the tensions that arose. And it was them who continually fed into his gaming habit. As a matter of fact, they were doing everything they could to make sure Roger always had a computer that supported the games he wanted to play. And when his computer broke down, he got a new one. And when a new game was released, he always got it right away. And it was his parents who thought sending their son to Santa Barbara was a solution to his problems, when in reality, it was a solution to their problems. And Roger was keenly aware of this. They wanted to be rid of him. Nobody wants to feel as though their parents will pay any price to not have you around. Kira C. said that she felt like Roger was an entitled little rich boy, but unfortunately, felt like he didn't receive love and attention from his parents the way that he should have. In her opinion, he wasn't a bad-looking guy, and he was definitely average in height, something that Zach V. had pointed out in his comments as well. To Kira, Roger created this pity party for himself. Mandy B. also said that Roger sounded like a spoiled little whiny ass who brought most of his issues into his own life himself. She said his mother should have disciplined him more and bought him less material possessions, and that the stepmother should have backed off just a tad. She also said something that I thought as well, that they should have made him stick out a sport too, that some team camaraderie would have helped him. And the parents definitely needed to seek out some professional help. Maureen R. pointed out that to not excuse his parents, but Roger had two therapists and was prescribed medication that he refused to take because he researched them on the internet and believed he didn't need to take them, that there were better drugs that the therapist could have prescribed. She also remembers reading somewhere that Roger's dad and one of his friends, or both of them, took him to Las Vegas in an attempt to get him laid. And what Maureen thought was most chilling about Roger is what he thought should take the place of our current society if he had his way. And I totally agree. Basically, the elimination of sex and putting women into breeding labs. Ridiculous ideas this guy had for sure. Bill S. said that Roger's lack of social skills was very evident, and he was quick to say inappropriate things to his friends and family. Bill could see why Roger turned off a lot of people, but Roger was the only one who couldn't understand why. Alfonso J. chimed in again and said that Roger was a whiny, selfish douchebag, that his document he wrote was not a manifesto, that this was a Cry Me a River diatribe. Girls, girls, girls. Like, quit thinking with the head down there and think with the head between your two shoulders. Sex isn't the pinnacle of life. Other things exist, but he was too much in his own wow, wow, wow mode to discover it. And this is a good point. I wasn't sure what to make of his fixation on sex, if this was normal or if it was all amplified because he wasn't getting any. But then again, Roger's idea of women, sex, relationships, and love was way off to begin with. In another comment thread that began a couple days ago, Michael E. had three words for us. The supreme gentleman. This is one of those things, I have a hard time where to categorize it. It's so ridiculous to me, it's almost comical, but there's nothing funny about it because Roger wasn't kidding. He called himself the closest thing to a living God. He viewed himself as superior to everyone, and he blamed the world for not being able to see it. How in the world do you fix that? Allison M. said that she had seen Roger's dad in an interview in 2020, and to her it was painful to watch. Then no parent likes to see his child hurting. No parent likes to see his child do something as terrible as what Roger did. She was afraid to listen to this series of episodes on Elliot Roger, and I totally get it. She isn't the only one. People despise this guy. This is pretty much the consensus. She felt like Roger wanted to fit in, but because he didn't, he took his anger and frustration out on innocent people. She questions us. Do we remember wanting to fit in when we were a teenager and never really being quite able to? Sure. Yeah. Many of us, if not all of us, totally wanted to fit in at some point. But Lisa B. said that the difference between us wanting to fit in and Roger wanting to fit in is different just by the sheer fact that he shot and killed numerous people. And nearly every child wants to fit in, but not every child goes and makes an hours-long confessional and then goes and kills people. That she's empathetic a lot of times in cases when most people aren't. But in the case of Elliot Roger, not so much. Premeditated murder is not just something your average teen who wants to fit in does. Both of you ladies make very, very valid points. And I pointed out in the discussion on Facebook that I agreed that Roger's parents could not have seen this coming. And that I myself teetered between the feelings of empathy and anger towards the whole story of Elliot Roger. I had not read his manifesto or watched his videos prior to researching this case, because I thought I would be cringing through the whole thing, which I mostly did. But at the same time, it gave me a place to finally land on how I felt about him and his parents. And to me, as far as fitting in is concerned, on the surface, it may have looked like Roger wanted to fit in, but I felt like he saw himself as entitled to the admiration, wealth, power, and women, and grew violently angry and envious because he was quote-unquote denied these things. I question how much Roger actually tried to fit in, as opposed to expecting to be accepted by virtue of being a supreme gentleman. Teddy G found it difficult to have a great deal of sympathy for Roger's parents, particularly his biological mother. He viewed her as an enabler and spoiled him beyond belief, and he found him to be infuriating. He saw Roger's words like this: "My horrible stepmother has rules, and she made me do things I didn't want to do. And my mommy never made me do anything. And my mommy bought me everything I demanded the minute I demanded it. My stepmother isn't the boss of me. Blah, blah, blah." And his father just kept ignoring everything while his mother kept buying stuff and letting him do whatever he wanted. And Teddy would describe Roger as a typical rich brat. And Linda A. had a bit of advice for anyone listening to the series, that you might want to listen to Roger's videos on YouTube before you listen to my rendition of his manifesto, because you might begin to feel sorry for Roger due to the manner in which I read his words. And I get it, but I told Linda A., that may be true, and no matter how I come across, these are still his ugly words. Okay, so the comments are still coming through on this on Facebook, so I'm going to scroll through my phone real quick, so bear with me as I look and see if there's anything else that anybody had to add. Hold on for a sec. Okay, so Laura A. posted on the page, "Seems pretty appropriate that I'm getting filled with impotent rage while listening to this manifesto." Okay, so I just ha-ha'd the comment. And Kim Cleveland said, "I was watching some of his YouTube BS. I'm magnificent. I've got style. Made me angry watching those too. The manifesto was just out of this world. This young man sure had delusions of grandeur." And Laura A. said, "I did that today too, and I'm still blown away that he seemed to think that everyone should magically recognize that he was awesome and he shouldn't have to initiate any interactions at all." Jennifer V. said that she's still shocked at how selfish and entitled a person can be and that it's really scary. She finds his demeanor as frightening as the demeanor of any serial killer or murderer, which is pretty much what Elliot Roger turned out to be, right? Good old Darren J. chimed in again. "Considering Elliot thinks of women as nothing more than sex workers, why didn't he ever consider using one?" Dave W. said, "Probably because that's not how he really felt. He held women in high regard and wanted them badly. He was rejected at every turn. So to make himself feel better about not being able to get what he so coveted, he tried to convince himself that they were beneath him. Not sure why he didn't go that route, though. That may have worked for him. Maybe he assumed they would reject him, too." I did find that comment to be a little bit funny, but I do think that using a sex worker would have been beneath Roger's standards for himself. Mandy B. said that she doesn't know if he really did hold women in high regard. He had stated to his mother that he wanted her to sacrifice her happiness for his when asking her to marry the millionaire boyfriend. She thinks a lot can be said about his relationship with his mother. He used her to his benefit and manipulated her at every turn. She thinks that he probably thought all women, hell, even all human beings, were beneath him. He thought so highly of himself as such a beautiful, magnificent, perfect being that why his magnificent magical hand wasn't enough to satisfy himself. Yeah, makes sense, right? I mean, he loved himself best, so whatever. And Anna T. had this observation of Elliot Rodger. He sounds like a 19th century British villain. And so I set my servant upon fire because the wretched dared let my tea get cold. Ah, oh, why must I bear such a cruel existence? I wish I had a better British accent, but yeah, Elliot Rodger was definitely all about the theatrics in his videos. Again, I want to thank all of you who commented, and I'm sorry if I missed you. I just had to get this recorded, and I included as many of your comments as I possibly could have. So, I want to move on to talking about the incel movement. Out of all of this would be this movement. An online subculture known as the incel movement, or the beta uprising. And it is something that everyone needs to take notice of and be aware of. Incel is short for involuntarily celibate, and the beta uprising refers to the beta male uprising. Earlier this year, in April of 2018, just before running down pedestrians in Toronto, Canada, resulting in the deaths of 10 people, Alec Manassian posted a message praising the Supreme Gentleman Elliot Rodger. Manassian is thought to have belonged to a part of this internet incel subculture, a group of men who believe that they have been excluded from fulfilling not only their sexual desires, but the ability to date and generally establish relationships with women due to their physical appearance. According to an article I read, the incel movement has been aligned with the segment of a broader strand of young, mostly white males being radicalized online. It does have some similarities to the alt-right movement, as both groups attribute society's problems and social liberalism as being caused by women and ethnic minorities. Incels feel feminism and social justice are to blame for the imbalance in the dating scene, and people of non-white ethnicities and racial identities are spoken about in a derogatory manner. And within the most extreme fringe of the movement, Elliot Rodger is hailed as a martyr for their cause and an inspiration. And in some of the most extreme opinions of the most hardline believers in the incel movement, they support and promote rape, violence, and even murder as justified ways of drawing attention to the problem of sexually frustrated men. One of the most popular proposals for retribution are acid attacks, as they can cause disfigurement of the victim. While others suggest the solution for fair distribution of sex would be the enslavement of women. Remember, Rodger believed in a world where sex should be banned and women are kept locked up for purposes of procreation. There are moderate believers in the group who distance themselves from the actions of killers like Rodger and Manassian. They call themselves brain cells, and they are clear that they do not support, encourage, or glorify any violence or physical harm or those who commit such crimes. It is the more radicalized segments of the group that praise the actions of these killers and glorify them as heroes for their cause. The incel movement, at its worst, is a new kind of terrorism based on a very extreme form of misogynism. It's men, and only men, who are a part of this group. They ridicule women who are absolutely banned from any of their groups, and they get together online and lament about their lack of sex, and they echo much of the same stuff that you heard from Elliot Rodger. They view sex as something that is owed to them by women, but they are consistently denied it because it's always being given to more attractive or wealthy men instead of them. If you think that's backwards and weird, you aren't alone. These men get together on web forums and pretty much always online, and they angrily complain about the lack of sex in their lives. And what ends up happening is they collectively begin to develop a very toxic view of their circumstance with a twisted kind of logic. Instead of talking to one another, as you would in a typical support group or forum, about how to find a woman in a way that is safe and healthy and well-meaning, or to find ways to improve upon themselves as individuals, improving on their self-image or their overall approach to things, figuring out ways to become genuinely attractive and appealing, they decide that they're going to accept their fate, that they just aren't going to have the sex that they're owed. And some even go so far as to embrace it. In their minds, a woman can have sex whenever she wants, and a man can't. And to them, this is at the peak of unfairness and injustice. Remember, these men feel like sex is owed to them, but they don't get it because women are superficial in their thinking, that women are stupid, and lack the ability to make proper choices. And from this spawns an immense and profound hatred for all women. Women are discussed as though we are subhuman, referring to us in terms that label us as less than human, things like femoids or female humanoid organisms. And they hate women. And the hate is festering. And not only do they hate women, they hate the society that continues to allow their perceived oppression to continue on. As a woman and the mother of a young woman, I find this to be a terrifying reality. Fortunately, I don't know any men in my life or in our group or anyone who listens to our show who would align themselves to the extreme fringes of a movement like this. All I can do is hope that these men are able to vent and fume about their issues with women and that it never spills over beyond the confines of the internet. When you have those who take their violence into the community the way that Roger and Manassian did, it heightens our fears of them. We perceive them as dangerous because of their actions, and there are a lot of them, with estimates placing followers of the incel movement into the tens of thousands. But a select few incels who have been willing to speak out would say that being an incel is not about violence or misogyny, but rather a way of looking for a camaraderie of peers where they can speak freely and honestly about their feelings of being ostracized and disconnected. While there is a fragment of the group, a small fragment who takes the ideology behind the movement and twists it into something more violent, it's not the overall philosophy for everyone. But there are those who are violent, and they talk about violence. And it doesn't seem that they're moderated as much as they should be. The incel Reddit was removed, but they moved it to a subreddit called Brain Cell. And there are still the same violent and dehumanizing things being said about women. And more I learn about this, the more I'm seeing that it's not just about sex, but it's about power and hating women. And maybe the violent ones are the exception. They are few and far between. But it doesn't diminish the overall sentiments this movement has subscribed to. I also wanted to share with you an article that I told you about earlier that Christy shared with me in the discussion group about Elliot Roger. It was an article written in the Daily Beast entitled "Your Princess is in Another Castle, Misogyny, Entitlement, and Nerds" by Arthur Chu. He writes, "I was going to write about the Big Bang Theory. Why, as a nerdy viewer, I sometimes like it and sometimes have a problem with it. Why I think there's a backlash against it. Then some maniac shot up a sorority house in Santa Barbara and posted a manifesto proclaiming that he did it for revenge against women denying him sex. And then the weekend just generally went to hell. So now my plans have changed. With my apologies to Big Bang Theory fans, this is all I wanted to say about the Big Bang Theory. When the pilot aired, it was 2007, and nerd culture and geek chic were on everyone's lips. And yet still, the basic premise of the sitcom Nerb was once again awkward but lovable, has a huge unreciprocated crush on a hot, non-nerdy popular girl, and also has an annoying roommate. This annoys me. This is a problem. Because let's be honest, this device is old. We have seen it over and over again. Steve Urkel, Screech, Skippy on Family Ties, Niles on Frasier. We male nerds grow up force-fed this script. Lusting after women, quote, out of our league, was what we did. And those unattainable hot girls would always inevitably reject us because they didn't understand our intellectual interest in science fiction and comic books and would instead date asshole jocks. This was inevitable. And our only hope was to be unyieldingly persistent until we earned a chance with these women by being there for them when she saw the error of her ways. This is, to put it mildly, a problematic attitude to grow up with. Fixating on a woman from afar and then refusing to give up when she acts like she's not interested is generally something that ends badly for everyone involved. But it's a narrative that nerds and nerd media keep repeating. I'm not breaking new ground by saying this. It's been said very well, over and over again. But the overall problem is one of a culture where instead of seeing a woman as a person, a protagonist of their own stories, just like we are of ours, men are taught that women are things to earn, to win. That if we try hard enough and persist long enough, that we will get the girl in the end. Like life is a video game, and women, like money and status, are just a part of the reward we get for doing so well. So what happens to nerdy guys who keep finding out that the princess they were promised is always in another castle? When they do everything right, they get good grades, they get a decent job, and that the wife that they were promised in the package deal doesn't arrive. When the persistent, passive-aggressive nice guy act fails, do they step it up to elaborate Steve Urkel-esque stalking stunts? Do they try elaborate Revenge of the Nerd-style ruses? Do they buy into the pickup artist snake oil, started by nerdy guys for nerdy guys, filled with techniques to manipulate, pressure, and in some cases, outright assault women to get what they want? Or when that doesn't work, and they spent hours a day on sites bitching about how it doesn't work, like Elliot Rogers hangout on PUAHate.com. And sometimes, do they buy some handguns, leave a manifesto on the internet, and then drive off to a sorority house to murder as many women as they can? No. I'm not saying most frustrated nerdy guys are rapists and potential rapists. I'm certainly not saying that all are potential mass murderers. I'm not saying that most lonely men who put women up on pedestals will turn on them with hostility and rage once they get frustrated enough. But I have known nerdy male stalkers. And yes, nerdy male rapists. I have known situations where I knew something was going on, but I didn't say anything because I didn't want to stick my neck out, because some vile part of me thought that this kind of thing was normal because, in other words, I was a coward and I had the privilege of ignoring the problem. I've heard and seen the stories that those of you who followed the Yes All Women hashtag on Twitter have seen. Women getting groped at cons. Women getting vicious insults flung at them online. Women getting stalked by creeps in college and told that they should be flattered. I've heard Elliot Rogers' voice before. I was expecting his manifesto to be incomprehensible madness, hoping for it to be. But it wasn't. It's a standard, frustrated, angry, geeky guy manifesto, except for the part about mass murder. I've heard it from acquaintances. I've heard it from friends. I've heard it come out of my own mouth in moments of anger and weakness. It's the same motivation that makes a guy in college stalk a girl, leave her unsolicited gifts, and finally, when she tells him to quit, it makes him leave angry posts about her shallowness and cruelty on Facebook. It's the same motivation that makes guys rant about fake cosplay girls at cons and how much he hates them for their vain, teasing ways. The one that makes a guy suffering career or personal problems turn on his wife because it's her job to support him by patching up all the holes in his life. The one that makes a wealthy entrepreneur hit his girlfriend 117 times on camera for her infidelity, and then, after getting off with the misdemeanor, still put up a blog post casting himself as the victim. And now, that motivation has led to 6 people dead and 14 more injured, with the killer leaving a 140-page rant and several YouTube videos describing exactly why he did it. No, he said, she said. No muffled sounds through the dorm ceiling. No, maybe he has other issues. The fruits of our culture's ingrained misogyny laid bare for all to see. And yet, when this story broke, the initial mainstream coverage only talked about mental illness, not misogyny. And it's a line that people are now fervently exhorting us to stick to, even after the manifesto's contents were revealed. Yet another high-profile tech resignation ensued when the co-founder of Rap Genius decided Roger's manifesto was a hilarious joke. People found one of the girls Rogers was obsessed with and began questioning if her bullying may have somehow triggered his rage. And worst of all, he has fan pages that still haven't been taken down on Facebook, filled with angry, frustrated men singing his praises and seriously suggesting that the onus is on women to offer sex to men to keep them from going on rampages. So a question to my fellow male nerds. What the F is wrong with us? How much longer are we going to be in denial that there is a thing called rape culture and we ought to do something about it? No, not the straw man that all men are constantly plotting rape, but that we live in an entitlement culture where guys think that they need to be having sex with girls in order to be happy and fulfilled. That in a culture that constantly celebrates the narrative of guys trying hard, overcoming challenges, concocting clever ruses, and automatically getting a woman thrown at them as a prize as a result, there will always be some guy who crosses the line into committing a violent crime to get what he quote-unquote deserves or to get vengeance for being denied it. To paraphrase the great John Oliver, listen up, fellow self-pitying nerd boys. We are not the victims here. We are not the underdogs. We are not the ones who have our ownership over our bodies and our emotions stepped on constantly by other people's entitlement. We are not the ones where 1 out of 6 of us will have someone violently attempt to take control of our bodies in our lifetimes. We are not Lewis from Revenge of the Nerds. We are not Steve Urkel from Family Matters. We are not Preston Myers from Can't Hardly Wait. We are not Seth Rogen in every movie Seth Rogen has ever been in. And we are not Mario racing to the castle to beat Bowser because we know that there's a princess in there waiting for us. We are not the lovable, nerdy protagonist who's lovable because he's the protagonist. We are not guaranteed to get laid by a hot chick of our dreams as long as we work hard enough at it. There isn't a team of writers or a studio audience pulling for us to triumph by getting the girl in the end. And when our clever ruses and schemes to get the girls fails, It's not because the girls are too stupid or too bitchy or too shallow to play those unwritten rules that we've absorbed. It's because other people's bodies and other people's love are not something that can be taken, not even something that can be earned. They can be given freely, by choice, or not. We need to get that. We really, really need to get that if our half of the species is ever going to be worth a damn. Not getting that means that there will always be some percent of us who will be rapists and abusers and killers. And it means that the rest of us will always, on some fundamental level, be stupid and wrong when it comes to trying to understand women that we claim to love. What did Elliot Rodger need? He didn't need to get laid. None of us nerdy, frustrated guys needed to get laid. When I was an asshole with rants full of self-pity and entitlement, getting laid would not have helped me. He needed to grow up. We all do. Thank you, Christy, again for sharing this article. I really appreciate the perspective coming from a self-professed nerdy guy. And he wasn't afraid to confront the problems that he saw with the whole culture surrounding these issues. Again, this article was written by Author Chu. Okay, dreamers, so another day has passed since the beginning of this recording, and we've had a few more Facebook comments that I'm going to add in real quick before I finally wrap this up. This is going to have to be it, otherwise we're going to be talking about Elliot Rodger forever. Okay, so Darren J. had another comment. He's been chiming in on the story several times, and he wanted to make sure that he got a mention. So here he is again for about the third time. I'm assuming he's finished now with the three parts of the series, and he had this to say about Elliot Rodger. I think this is what happens when you grow up with parents who just give you everything you want without ever having to work or earn anything. You grow up thinking that you're entitled to absolutely everything. You want a new laptop? You get one. You want designer clothes? You get them. You want an expensive car? Here you go. Want to spend your entire free time locked away playing games? Go ahead. You don't want to work? Mom and dad will fund your life. And then the spoiled, entitled little bastard wants to have sex. He simply cannot understand why he can't have it. After all, he can have everything he wants, right? This is a guy who goes out for walks with the expectations of coming back with a girlfriend. A guy who doesn't care about personality, sense of humor, common interests, just looks. A guy who hates his sister's boyfriend because he's a freeloader. A perfect demonstration of irony. This, dreamers, is what happens when you allow your child to grow up thinking that they can have anything they want and do what they want without having to work for anything. Everything he wanted, he got, except for one thing, girls. And he just couldn't deal with that. Lacey R. agreed, saying that this kid was delivered everything he wanted in life on a silver platter. It never occurred to him to earn a damn thing and to just be angry when other people didn't do enough to make him happy. If parents ever feel bad for not being able to give their kids something that they want, they should listen to this and pat themselves on the back for being such a great parent. Tanya T. agreed too, but also added that Rodger was never taught any plain human interaction skills. No sense of humor, no personality. And it's no wonder that no one wanted to be near him, because he was just awful. Rebecca B. added, in regards to the time when Rodger didn't like the one child that was in his class and he was allowed to not invite that child to his birthday party, Rebecca said that she's thrown parties for her kids over the years, and you basically either have a small group or you have everyone. She would never allow her six-year-old to say that the whole class could come except for one child. It's a way to teach your child that they will have to learn to get along with people that they may not really like, just like in real life when you have coworkers that you don't particularly care for. And this I totally agree with. The fact that his parents allowed him to unilaterally exclude one child, that sets a precedent early on. That entitlement, that sense that he could just pick and choose people based on his own superficial judgments and preconceived notions. Roger learned early on how to dismiss and dispatch people that he didn't like at will. Shelley M. said that she feels like there was something more going on than just bad parenting, and she wonders about the other children in the family and if they behave the same way. Well, I will tell you this. In an article that I'm about to go over in just a few minutes, you will hear from a friend of the family. He was a colleague of Peter Roger. Shelley guessed a personality disorder, and I tend to agree with that. Tanya T. said that she feels like it might be on the Asperger spectrum. I don't think anyone has mentioned that before, and I'm with you, Tanya. I'm not an expert either. But if he were in fact on the spectrum, that might explain some of his personality quirks. I've worked with many a young child in my time, and there are definitely signs when something isn't going quite right in the socialization department. And it certainly stands out. So maybe something like this was going on with Roger that might explain some of the behaviors he exhibited early on, the things that stood out as being somewhat defiant, like the extreme dislike of the school uniform, the knee-high socks in particular. Some children on the spectrum take issue with certain feels and textures. Maybe his refusal to sit crisscross applesauce for the class picture. His emotional breakdowns, the tantrums. There were lots of red flags when he was growing up. Shauna S. said that she's still wondering what type of household Roger was raised in. Did they eat together and converse with one another during dinner? Sure, he cried to his parents and we heard his side of how that went, but there has to be more. She agrees that this is definitely something that happens when a child is brought up with a silver spoon and no consequences. But the thing that bothers her is that he was an innocent child at one point. Did they not see the red flags? Were they just too self-absorbed to see that their child clearly needed an intervention? Sad, because we all know in the end that innocent lives were senselessly taken. And Cynthia C. agreed with all that everyone is saying, but she thinks that there is more than just him being a spoiled brat, as there are many spoiled kids that don't turn to mass murder, which is very true. She thinks, and I agree, that Roger was broken from the start. A personality disorder, possibly on the autism spectrum. Darren J. doesn't feel like autism is something Roger would have been diagnosed with, and neither does Mandy B. But Libby B. put it quite bluntly. Roger was a dickwad, and his actions can't be excused by using the autism spectrum. Everyone had so many good and valid points, and I know many of us are not exactly experts at all this, but it really is fascinating bouncing all of these ideas around. Okay, so I have to move on, otherwise we are never going to get to the end of this. So in our discussions, we questioned a lot as to what could have been done differently that may have possibly prevented something like this from happening. We question his parents and their styles of child rearing and discipline. We question Roger's own tactics in working through his socialization skills or lack thereof. We wonder if he just would have found that one girl willing to give him a chance. And we wonder if this tragedy could have somehow been avoided. Did anyone see how truly disturbed this young man was? Yeah, I believe so. At least one person noticed, and he talked about it in an article on the BBC website, Hollywood screenwriter Dale Lawner. He's written movies such as Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, My Cousin Vinny, and Blind Date. He met Roger's dad, Peter, from working with him about 15 years earlier, and a year prior to the tragedy, Peter Roger had confided in Dale that His son was frustrated because he lacked experience with women. He knew Roger, and he tried to help, at one time, solve Roger's problems with women. Dale's article said that the night before the killings, around 9:18 p.m., Roger had sent him and 22 others an email containing his so-called manifesto. It had many of the complaints that he knew Roger to have mentioned before about women in society, but the manifesto was more focused and filled with anger. Dale immediately grew concerned for Roger. It was written in such a way that made him think that it was a suicide note of sorts. He did think, when he read the email, that Roger was maybe becoming unhinged. The following morning, Dale woke up and checked his email. A friend of his sent him a message telling him that he knew the Isla Vista shooter. Dale had hoped that he hadn't killed anybody, but of course, he had, to his horror and shock. Though Dale had never considered himself responsible for the tragedy, he couldn't help but feel guilty. He wondered if there was anything that he could have done to stop it, even though there was no way to know what was about to happen. In Dale's words, the Elliot portrayed in the manifesto and in the video he made was not the Elliot that I remember. The person in that video was cocky, arrogant, and hateful. The Elliot that I knew was very meek, timid, and awkward. He said the first time that he met Roger, he was about 8 or 9 years old, and he could see that there was something wrong with him. He admits that he's not a psychologist, but looking back now, Roger struck him as someone who was broken from the moment of conception. It seemed to him that Roger had an overwhelming lack of confidence, but not in a particularly endearing way. Roger was sad, not endearing. He found himself hoping that inside there was a normal kid wanting to come out, that he would overcome his shyness and bloom in some way. But what became evident to Dale, only after reading the manifesto and watching the video, was what he was actually hiding was this horribly twisted little monster. In the past, at times, Roger had shown some bitterness and even some veiled anger, but that anger wasn't even remotely acted out in any way. He never raised his voice. He didn't even seem capable of raising his voice. He didn't slam doors or pound his fists. Dale couldn't even imagine him making a fist. In retrospect, you can point out a few clues, a few cracks to the malevolence percolating underneath, but they were overshadowed by someone who seemed incapable of any kind of action. He did not simmer or seethe. The boldness he showed in that video wasn't something he'd ever seen before. Dale met Roger a few times and they emailed a lot. To him, Roger seemed convinced that women hated him, but he could never tell Dale why. It seemed like Roger would perceive cruelness or hatefulness when in fact, Dale suspected Roger was simply being ignored. Dale once gave him an assignment so he could try to establish some kind of dynamic with a woman. He told Roger that when he sees a woman the next time he's on campus, and you like her hair or her sunglasses, just pay her a compliment. He explained to Roger that it's a freebie, something in passing. You're not trying to make conversation, and just keep walking. Don't make any eye contact, just give the free compliment. The idea was that he might make a friend if he made someone feel good. He told Roger in the next few weeks, if you see them, they'll likely give you a smile, and you can smile back, and eventually turn this into chit-chat. A few weeks later, Dale got in touch with Roger and asked him if he gave it a try. Roger told him no. When Dale asked why not, Roger told him Why do I have to give them a compliment? Why don't they compliment me? At that point, Dale realized Elliot Roger was very, very troubled. Dale said in one of the last emails he sent to him, he became frustrated with Roger. He pointed out that he had the choice to change his circumstances, and if he didn't make the effort, then he had to take some of the blame. In turn, Roger insisted that he had someone to blame for his troubles, and he didn't blame himself. People did try to help him. He was getting support, but he was such a sad little character. Whenever you saw him, he was always unhappy. A mutual friend of Dale's once said, "I've never seen Elliot smile." Some people think the manifesto he wrote was a fairly accurate assessment of his life, when in fact it was very skewed. He portrayed his stepmother as some kind of cruel, horrible character out of a fairy tale, but she is a lovely, kind, decent woman. His brother and sister are normal, vibrant, charming children. But from reading his manifesto, that's something he seemed to resent. For his family, every day is now a bad day, and they're trying their best to cope with it. It is such a difficult thing to have this kid that you loved his whole life, and then he does this terrible, horrible thing that just makes you so angry. Trying to reconcile those two feelings is a very hard thing to do. When people like Roger can go into a store and buy a gun, that makes America less safe. Dale points out that he is not anti-gun and that he owns guns himself, but laments that people like Roger should not be owning guns. And it is his hope that things will change and we can find some way of ensuring that dangerous people cannot access guns. But it is difficult because it wasn't until the very end did Roger reveal his violent nature. Roger wasn't one who was clearly out of control. Maybe looking back, there were glimpses of his callousness that may have been a clue. But mostly, Elliot Roger was a very controlled, passive, and retiring person. Since the massacre, Dale questioned, what was wrong with Roger? What made him do this? It's something that he thought about a lot. And all he can do was equate it to an experience he had when he was young. His family had a dog that gave birth to 5 puppies. 4 of them were very lovely, normal, happy little puppies. But the 5th one was smaller than the rest. He would tremble. He was never any fun. He wouldn't play. He was always afraid. And it isn't ever clear why this puppy was like this. But whatever it was just like Elliot Roger. On May 26, 2014, the Los Angeles Times ran an article entitled, "Who They Were, The Isla Vista Victims." George Chen, age 19. George was from San Jose, California, and he was among the 3 young men found dead with multiple stab wounds in Roger's apartment. He was listed on the apartment's lease along with Roger and Chang Hong. Both of George's parents are engineers, and they wanted their son to follow in their footsteps. George wanted to work at Lockheed Martin, his mother Kelly said. She always looked forward to his visits. George would often pick up his elderly neighbor's mail or take out their trash. He also volunteered for a Buddhist-based organization, Zhu Qi. He was always very sweet and helpful. He had always been a very smart kid. Catherine Brianne Cooper, age 22. What childhood friends remember most about Catherine Cooper was her energy. Katie, they said, was unbeatable at foot races, hide and seek, and catching up with the ice cream truck when it rolled through their tidy Chino Hills neighborhood. That girl could run, recalled Phoenix Morales, who attended grade school with Katie. She'd beat anyone who dared to run against her. Then she'd just stand there, laughing and trying to catch her breath. Katie went on to become an art history and archaeology student at UC Santa Barbara, and she was a member of the Delta 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 sorority. Katie was a wonderful kid, Morales added. Chang Hong, age 20. Chang was a computer science student who grew up in Taipei, according to his Facebook page. He graduated in 2010 from Lynbrook High School in San Jose. Blake Hefner, an electrical engineering major at UC Santa Barbara, met Chang last October at a programming marathon put together by the local chapter of the IEEE, an electrical and electronics engineering organization. He was a really nice guy. He seemed really innocent. During the worldwide 24-hour programming competition, IEEE sent out a series of problems, and Hefner remembers Chang being helpful even though they were on different teams. He was just really a smart guy. He gave us tips and we kind of just talked and became friends. Classmates who knew Chang were devastated by the news. Hefner said one of my friends was paired with him at a career fair, and he was pretty sad about Chang's death, especially after hearing about how gruesome it was. Chang was one of the three young men stabbed to death by Roger. According to authorities, in January, Roger had accused Chang of stealing three candles valued at $22. When Chang said he didn't know where the candles were, Roger performed a citizen's arrest and called 911. Sheriff's deputies found the candles on Chang's bed, and he was arrested and charged with a petty theft infraction. This strange incident was one of three times that authorities contacted Roger prior to his rampage. Christopher Ross Michaels Martinez, age 20. He was the only child of two attorneys, his mother, a deputy district attorney, and his father, a criminal defense attorney. Christopher grew up in San Luis Obispo and graduated from San Luis Obispo High School in 2012. A studious kid and an avid reader, he was also an athlete from a very young age, beginning with soccer and then going on to play football and basketball. He was preparing for a year study program abroad in London when he died. He had traveled from a very young age, visiting France and Spain and Italy with his dad, and returning to Europe with high school classmates. He was just a terrific kid in every way, his dad said. You really couldn't ask for a better kid, and I'm not just saying that because I'm his dad. Weihan Wang, age 20. He was from Fremont, California, and he was also among the three men that Roger had stabbed in the apartment. He graduated from Fremont Christian School and was planning on spending the summer with his parents, according to his mom, Jane. Weihan and his parents emigrated from mainland China a decade earlier. Jane told KNTV on Monday that her son was upset by the loud music that Roger was playing in the middle of the night and decided that he wanted to move to another apartment for the next school year. Jane, a nurse, said that she and her husband Charlie are devastated by the death of their only child. What can I do without my son? She said. My son, my whole life. I'm so proud of him. Veronica Weiss, age 19. Bob Weiss said his daughter Veronica was wise and mature beyond her years. He would go to her for advice sometimes if he was having a problem with her brothers, Cooper and Jackson, even a minor argument with his wife. His daughter was always a tomboy. She played 4 sports in high school: cross country, baseball, swimming, and water polo. She earned straight A's. Her strength was math. Starting at age 6, she loved playing softball, he said. Later, she played baseball. He said she was the only girl out of 500 players in the Westlake Baseball League. She was tough. She was a big, strong girl, and she was tough. He said she always organized events for her circle of friends. He described her friends as nerds and serious students. They would study every Friday night, and it was not unusual for her to spend Sundays working on her advanced math work. She loved it. He said many of her friends went on to other prestigious schools, such as Princeton, and she wanted to go to the University of Washington, but the out-of-state tuition and financial situation made that prohibitive. She would always wear purple and gold of the University of Washington. She wanted to be a financial wizard, and she wanted to use her high aptitude in complicated math. Her mother and her grandmother belonged to the Tri Delta sorority, so it made sense that she would want to join at UC Santa Barbara. Her dad said, "She will always be an inspiration to me every day of my life, and there was never a day I wasn't proud of her. Never a single day." And with that, dreamers, this finally brings the Isla Vista tragedy, the tale of the manifesto and the misogynist, to a close. The conversation is still ongoing as I type all of this, and I wish I could squeeze everything in, but I just can't. And I want to thank you all so much for your comments and your insight into the mind of this killer. And I'm sorry if I missed any of you. This is probably one of the longest conversations we've had on a case. So I'm finally going to put this story to bed. Until next time, sweet dreams.